rescued Israel that day, and the battle moved on beyond Beth Aven. Now the men of Israel were in distress that day because Saul had bound the people under an oath, saying, "Cursed be any man who eats food before evening comes, before I have avenged myself on my enemies." So none of the troops tasted food. The entire army entered the woods, and there was honey on the ground. When they went into the woods, they saw the honey oozing out, yet no one put his hand to his mouth because they feared the oath. But Jonathan had not heard that his father had bound the people with the oath. So he reached out the end of the staff that was in his hand, and he dipped it into the honeycomb. He raised his hand to his mouth, and his eyes brightened. Then one of the soldiers told him, "Your father bound the army under a strict oath, saying, 'Cursed be any man who eats food today.' That's why the men are faint." Jonathan said, "My father has made trouble for the country. See how my eyes brightened when I tasted a little of this honey. How much better it would have been if the men had eaten today some of the plunder they took from their enemies. Would not the slaughter of the Philistines have been even greater?" That day, after the Israelites had struck down the Philistines from Michmash to Ajalon, they were exhausted. They pounced on the plunder, and taking sheep, cattle and calves, they butchered them on the ground and ate them, together with the blood. Then someone said to Saul, "Look, the men are sinning against the Lord by eating meat that has blood in it." "You have broken faith," he said. "Roll a large stone over here at once." Then he said, "Go out among the men and tell them, 'Each of you bring me your cattle and sheep, and slaughter them here and eat them. Do not sin against the Lord by eating meat with blood still in it.'" So everyone brought his ox that night and slaughtered it there. Then Saul built an altar to the Lord. It was the first time he had done this. Saul said, "Let's go down after the Philistines by night and plunder them till dawn, and let's not leave one of them alive." "Do whatever seems best to you," they replied. But the priest said, "Let's inquire of God here." So Saul asked God, "Shall I go down after the Philistines? Will you give them into Israel's hand?" But God did not answer him that day. Saul therefore said, "Come here, all you who are leaders of the army, and let's find out what sin has been committed today. As surely as the Lord who rescues Israel lives, even if it lies with my son Jonathan, he must die." But not one of the men said a word. Saul then said to all the Israelites, "You stand over there, I and Jonathan my son will stand over here." "Do what seems best to you," the men replied. Then Saul prayed to the Lord, the God of Israel, "Give me the right answer." And Jonathan and Saul were taken by lot, and the men were cleared. Saul said, "Cast the lot between me and Jonathan my son." And Jonathan was taken. Then Saul said to Jonathan, "Tell me what you have done." So Jonathan told him, "I merely tasted a little honey with the end of my staff, and now I must die." Saul said, "May God deal with me, be it ever so severely, if you do not die, Jonathan." But the men said to Saul, "Should Jonathan die, he who has brought about this great deliverance in Israel? Never. Surely as the Lord lives, not a hair of his head will fall to the ground, for he did this today with God's help." So the men rescued Jonathan, and he was not put to death. Then Saul stopped pursuing the Philistines, and they withdrew to their own land. After Saul had assumed rule over Israel, he fought against their enemies on every side. Moab, the Ammonites, Edom, the kings of Zoar, and the Philistines. Wherever he turned, he inflicted punishment on them. He fought valiantly and defeated the Amalekites, delivering Israel from the hands of those who had plundered them. Saul's sons were Jonathan, Ishvi, and Malchishua. The name of his older daughter was Merab, and that of the younger was Michal. But his wife's name was Ahinoam, daughter of Ahimaaz. The name of the commander of Saul's army was Abner, son of Ner, and Ner was Saul's uncle. Saul's father Kish and Abner's father Ner were sons of Abiel. All the days of Saul there was bitter war with the Philistines, and wherever Saul saw a mighty or brave man, he took him into his service.
Thanks, Ed. Well, I was in the town library a month or so ago returning some Thomas the Tank Engine DVDs and a Charlie and Lola book, and I saw that sitting around the edge of one of the walls of the library were about 10 couples talking to each other in little booths. So I asked someone there who looked like they knew what they were talking about what was going on, and they whispered to me that that this was an initiative in the library called Living Library Books. 10 people had volunteered to be read by strangers as though they were books. And the idea was that strangers would ask questions and have conversations with these books to find out what made them tick. There was a 30-minute time limit on each of the reading of these books. To me, the thought of reading one of these living books was quite enticing. I could have been like Andrew Denton on Enough Rope, except without the cameras and the national acclaim. But then I wondered what it would be like to be the person being read. What would it be like to be the living library book? What would I say to the reader if he or she asked me what made me tick? What would I say if they asked me what it was that shapes who I am? Who would I identify as being the person who has had the most profound influence on me if they asked me that question? What would I point to as the thing that gives my life meaning or happiness or purpose or fulfillment? How would I answer those questions? How would you answer those questions if someone were reading you? Well, over the next 20 minutes or so, I'm going to briefly look at this story and try to read Saul and Jonathan as though they were living library books. I'm going to ask them what makes them tick. And as we go along, occasionally, I'll come back to us and see how different we are to them, or maybe even how similar we are to them. And then to finish, I'll open another book. A living book who has no equal. And I'll show that if you read him right, if you get him, then he'll give you everything you'll ever need. Well, it's a long reading, isn't it? We've been sitting here for quite some minutes listening to Ed read that. You did a terrific job. Thanks, Ed. I'm not going to go through this verse by verse, you'll be pleased to know. But I think in order to get a sense of what it's about, we don't need to go through this verse by verse. At the very outset, though, we need to remember that the enemy facing the Israelites is the Philistine army. 3,000 chariots, 6,000 charioteers, heaps of horses, more soldiers that could be counted, and the Israelites, who Saul was king over, numbered about 600, and they were unarmed. But in spite of that, Jonathan is keen to take them on, the Philistines, with a young man who had the dubious pleasure of carrying his master's armour around, which I think probably means that every time the battle got thick and heavy and the spears were flying, this armour carrier had to hand all his stuff over to his boss and then look for a convenient tree to find somewhere, because he'd have nothing left. He should be on the TV show Worst Jobs in History, I think, this young guy. But meanwhile, as Jonathan gets set to do battle, our narrator shows us King Saul. And we can see that he's camping under a pomegranate tree with his men. And he's got Ahijah with him, who's wearing an ephod. And I think an ephod is less like a thong and more like an apron. And we're told this about Ahijah. We're told this by the narrator. We mentioned Ahijah because the narrator wants us to see what type of friends Saul is keeping. We're given his pedigree. And we can see that Ahijah comes from bad stock. Ichabod, Phineas, Eli. All these guys were crooks, you remember. They were the underbelly of Israel, really. So on the one hand, we've got Jonathan and his armour bearer with their tails in the air, climbing the slippery and thorny cliffs on their way to a fight that no one knows about. And on the other hand, we've got King Saul lying on his banana lounge under a pomegranate tree with a member of the mob. Well, if I were reading the living book, Jonathan, I want to know why it was that he thought he had any chance. "Why were you so optimistic, Jonathan?" I'd ask him as I sat there across from him. "The odds were completely stacked against you, and you had a crack. Why?" Well, at verse 6, he gives us the answer. It's got nothing to do with his ability to throw a spear or to scale a rocky cliff. In fact, it seems, if we look at verse 6, it seems that Jonathan knew he couldn't win. "Perhaps," he says, "perhaps the Lord will act on our behalf." "Nothing," he says, "can hinder the Lord from saving, whether by many or by few." He'd say to me, this isn't optimism. This is faith. And faith doesn't look at the circumstances. It looks to God. You see, compared to the power of God, the Philistines look like a piece of fluff that could be just blown away. God can do whatever he wants, Jonathan realized. Nothing is beyond him. Nothing can hinder the Lord from saving, says Jonathan, whether by many or by few. Our young son Hamish, when he was about 8 weeks old, needed to have an operation on his Achilles, on his heel. He was born with talipes, which I think is the new name for what used to be called club foot. And I went to see the orthopaedic surgeon, and he was a lovely chap, and we got talking, and I told him I used to be a lawyer. Doctors get very nervous when you tell them that you used to be a lawyer. Anyway, he told me that when he was an intern or a resident or whatever it is, when you're a junior orthopaedic surgeon, he was working with the best orthopaedic surgeon in Sydney. And they came to the operating list one day, and his boss, the best orthopaedic surgeon in Sydney, was due to operate on a 10-year-old daughter of the best barrister in Sydney, apparently. And after the daughter had been put under by the anaesthetist, but before the surgeon went into theatre to perform the operation, the barrister bailed up the orthopaedic surgeon and said, "I want you to give me a 100% guarantee that this operation will be a success." And the surgeon said he couldn't give that guarantee. So the barrister said, "Fine, that's okay, go ahead. But I want to let you know that if there are any complications, I will sue you for all you're worth, and I'll make sure that you never practice medicine in Sydney again." Well, without the surgeon told the anaesthetist to wake up the daughter. He was refusing to operate under those circumstances, and he left the theatre and told the barrister to explain to his daughter what had just happened as she came out of the anaesthetic. No one can give a 100% ironclad guarantee in life, not even the best orthopaedic surgeon. No one can do it except for God. He can do anything, anything. And unless you really know that's true, unless you really know that God is all-powerful, omnipotent, unless you really know that, you will never trust him with your life. And neither you should. An almost all-powerful God is not good enough for us. Jonathan knew that God could save. He believed in an all-powerful, omnipotent God. But he didn't assume that because God saved God, he didn't assume that just because God could save, that he would save. That's why he said, "Perhaps the Lord will act on our behalf." Faith, which is genuine, knows that God can do all things, but it submits to God's decisions. Because God is not only all-powerful, he's all-good. He never makes bad decisions. And we need to learn, like Jonathan, the perhaps of our faith. Well, one thing led to another, and before you know it, Jonathan and his young helper have scaled the cliff, killed 20 people, and panics filled the camp. And finally, Saul rolls out of his banana lounge. One of his lookouts back at Gibeah has seen that the Philistines are melting, they're going to water. So Saul's realised that some of his men have attacked the enemy without seeking his permission, without getting the all clear from him. And he wants to know who they are. So he summons his forces and does a head count to find out who's missing, a roll call, if you like. And he soon finds out that his son and his son's armour carrier aren't there. Then, verse 18, Saul asks that the Ark of the Covenant be brought to him. The Ark was the symbolic presence of God in the camp. And it looks as though, doesn't it? It looks as though Saul is returning to God and returning to a trust in him and returning to an obedience in him. But his ears pick up the din of the Philistines continuing to melt and go to water. So he quickly forgets about God and thinks only of himself. So with all the daring and bravado of a young bloke who likes pulling wings off flies, he joins the battle that was already as good as over. Here was his chance to shine, Saul was saying. Here was his chance to claim his victory. But he'd been outdone. And at verse 23, we're told by the narrator who it was that had outdone him. It wasn't his son Jonathan or the armour carrier. It was God. See what the narrator, looking down on this story afterwards, is telling us happened? He said at verse 23, "So the Lord rescued Israel that day." How Saul would hate to have read that. What Jonathan dared to hope might happen did happen. God won the battle, whether by many or by few. And Saul played pretty much no role in it at all. The king of Israel was a dud. But worse than that, he was a tyrant. He'd prevented his troops from eating all day. And because of that, even though they'd won the battle, even though they'd tasted success, they hadn't tasted food. And verse 24 tells us that the men were distressed. As someone who needs to eat every couple of hours, that's an understatement, I reckon. Distressed. We'll come back with me to the library. Let's go up to the booth where Saul's sitting. Let's read from the living book, which is Saul. And let's ask him, why did you make this silly law, King Saul? This law about not eating. Was it so that none of your men would desert you again? Did you think that if you told them they couldn't eat and promised them a big feed at the end of the day, they'd hang around for the battle and not desert you? Is that what you were doing here, King Saul? You know, I think that if Saul was honest with us in his booth, I think we'd be shocked at his answer. I think his reason for making this rule about not eating was actually much darker than we think. Because I think if we sat there across from Saul and asked him to answer that question, I think he'd tell us that he was trying to bump off his son. I think he wanted Jonathan dead. Remember the head count he'd done after the attack? Everyone was there and they knew that Jonathan and his armour bearer were the brave attackers. And I'm guessing, and probably I'm reading between the lines a bit here at the moment, but I'm guessing that there was some talk amongst the troops about how brave Jonathan was and about how lazy Saul was. So I reckon the king came up with a way of eliminating the problem. He made a law that he knew his son would never hear and would never be able to keep, and that his son would break. I think if we asked Saul what shaped his life and what made him tick, he'd tell us that he was driven by power, by a longing to be number one. See what he says there when he makes the law. "Cursed be any man who eats food before evening, before I have avenged myself on my enemies." Egocentric, self-centered. Jonathan looked away from himself to God. Saul looked away from God to himself. His lust for power consumed him. Well, I've been reading a book recently, written by a couple of American guys, Dan Allender and Tremper Longman III. Sounds like a golfer. And you never guess what he's called his son? Tremper. Tremper Longman IV. It's called Breaking the Idols of Your Heart. In fact, it's such a good book, I've bought it and I'm going to put it in the library. This is what they say about lust. They say, normally we think of lust as sexual, and it can be, but lust also involves a far bigger dynamic. It's essentially the compelling drive to get what we want and need by any means possible. To fill the emptiness of our souls through our own devices without turning to God. We all feel it, says Longman III and Allender. We all feel it, the painful void in the centre of our lives. That inner ache is meant to drive us toward relationship with God. But too often we use it to justify rebellion. Lust is the dark intention to find an earthly lover. Any person, any object, any idea that will meet our needs, take away our pain, and make us feel comfortable. It doesn't work, of course, they say. It cannot work. Obtaining the object of our lust only leaves us more empty, more susceptible to shame, and prey to even hungrier desires. The very nature of lust is that it can never be satisfied. Well, this is what Saul found himself in the clutches of, this lust. Like us, he had a painful void in the centre of his life, an inner ache that was meant to drive him in dependence towards God. But instead of turning towards God as Jonathan did, he used that inner ache to justify his rebellion. He wanted power so that he could feel okay about himself. And that meant, like an addict, to get his fix, he was prepared to do anything, even sacrifice his son. And for many of you, it will be exactly the same. You want to be the best at whatever you do. You want to be wealthy. You want to be happy. And that means you are prepared to do whatever it takes to get there. You mightn't even realise you're doing it. But many of you are. And it won't work. You'll feel more empty as your relationships around you crumble away. You might find that your lust to be the best at something ends up coming at a very heavy price. Your relationship with your son, your relationship with your daughter, your relationship with your girlfriend or boyfriend, your parents, your mates, and ultimately, your relationship with God. Saul wanted to be number one no matter what. So he set up this crazy law. And Jonathan fell straight into the trap. He ate some honey and he perked up no end. One of the soldiers tells him of his father's curse, and Jonathan gives his dad a spray and basically says that if his dad had allowed the army to eat before they went into battle, then they would have been able to finish the Philistines completely off. So with that, the whole army pounces on the captured Philistine food, and in their distressed state, they ignore the Levitical food laws and eat meat with blood still in it. So what did Saul do when he heard about this? What did he do? He made atonement for their sins. He built an altar and sacrificed cattle and sheep because of the sins of his people. There was no thought that he had done anything wrong. They were the ones, he said, who had broken faith, not him. By this stage, I think the story degenerates almost into this sort of litany of craziness in Saul. After the sacrifice, he comes up with the idea that his men should attack the Philistines at night. They haven't eaten all day. And then he decides to attack the Philistines at night and finish them off. At verse 37, he even attempts to bring God into the conversation, but God answers him with silence. So frantically, Saul changes his mind again and decides to prosecute his son for eating the honey and asks his men to help convict him, but his men answer him with the same silence that God had given him. Deserted by God and men, Saul forces a result by drawing lots, and his son loses. But not in the eyes of the people. Just as Jonathan had rescued them, they rescue Jonathan. And with that, verse 46, Saul throws his skirt up in the air, takes his bat and ball, and goes home. The end of the chapter tells it's true that he fought many battles during his reign as king over Israel. He defeated some mighty armies, but verse 52 leaves us and Saul with a bitter taste in our mouths, really. He continued to fight the Philistines. It was an ongoing battle. He never defeated his greatest enemy. The enemy that he was particularly commissioned by God to defeat eluded him to the very end. So we've read from the living book Jonathan, and we've seen in him that true faith looks away from itself and its circumstances to God. And we've read from the living book King Saul and seen in him a lust for power that he wrongly assumes will fill the aching void in the centre of his life. So what are we to do then with this bit of God's word, I wonder? Is this just a tale of two leaders? One good, one bad? Are we supposed to read this part of the Old Testament and decide, right, I'm going to try really hard now to be like Jonathan, and I'm going to try really hard to not be like Saul? And then after a little while we have a look at our lives and see that we've failed and we feel really guilty, and we decide, right, that's it, I'm going to try really, really hard now to be like Jonathan. And I'm going to try really, really hard not to be like Saul. Is that why God's given us these stories? Is that why he's told us about, in 52 verses, about these two men? Are these just examples for us to follow? Well, that's not the way that we are to read the Old Testament. The Old Testament is not about us. The Bible is not about us. It's about a third living book. We read these stories and we're meant to look away from ourselves to someone else. We need to spend time sitting down and listening to Jesus. Because when you do, you'll see that unlike Jonathan, who risked his life to save his people, Jesus gave his life to save his people. And as you spend time with Jesus, you'll see that unlike Saul, who lusted after power and was prepared to do anything to look good, Jesus humbled himself, became a servant, and was prepared to do anything, even go to a cross, to make you look good. And you'll realize, as you look to Jesus, that the painful void in the centre of your life is for him. At every level, Jesus is the perfect fit for you. So go after him. You get him, you will never need to lust for anything ever again. You fail him. You fail Jesus. What happens? What does he do? What does Jesus do if you fail him? He points to the cross. He says, I love you. Anyone who comes after me I will never cast out. What answers would you give to someone if they're asking you who you are building your life around? Let's pray. Our Heavenly Father, make us, we pray, living books on which every page is written the story of Jesus. Help us, please, to not be people who lust after things that ultimately destroy us, but help us instead to look to Jesus, to hear him say to us, even when we fail him, I love you, I forgive you. Anyone who comes after me, I will never cast out.